The court will now call U.S. v. Ali. Is the counsel for appellant ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you begin, I have a quick question, which is it your view that this is an as-applied challenge or a facial challenge to the statute that we're looking at? Because one of the amicus says that it's an as-applied count, but it's not clear to me from any of the briefs how that's so.
It's our view, Your Honor, that the court could reach the same conclusion either on constitutional grounds or on an as-applied grounds. The court could.
As-applied is a constitutional basis. The question is it unconstitutional on its face or only as applied or both? Which are you asking
yes,
us
Your
Honor, to rule
as,
on?
As applied, Your Honor.
Okay, so then my follow-up question would be, what would be circumstances under which it would be constitutional in your view?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has told us how we can constitutionally extend jurisdiction over civilians. In Giardo and in Toth, I'll start with Toth first. The court suggested that Congress create a media-type statute to extend Article III jurisdiction. But more specifically, to answer the court's question, in Gugliardo, the court emphasized the option that the military has for the enlistment of specialists. They gave examples such as the Navy Seabees. The Navy Paymaster case, United States v. Reed, would be another example of the functional equivalent of enlistment. The key is that the civilian is an actual member of the armed services.
Well, then he's not a civilian, is he?
Well, in the Navy Paymaster case, Your Honor, he maintained a quasi-civilian status, but he was clearly he signed an enlistment contract. He agreed to be subject to the orders of the ship's captain. He was even potentially eligible for a retirement from the Navy.
But, Consul, in that case, and in Toth and in Reed, weren't we dealing with individuals that were citizens of the United States? And who were, there was no question as to the applicability of the constitutional protections?
That's true, Your Honor. But as Justice Frankfurter stated in United States v. Reed in his concurrence, the notion that the Constitution is not operative outside the United States is a notion that has long since evaporated. So,
but that's with respect to United States citizens. I mean, there's many Supreme Court cases, I believe, that say the exact opposite when you're talking about non-U.S. citizens and the applicability of the Constitution outside the United States. But going back to my original question, am I to understand that the statute at issue would be constitutional only if people agreed that they would be subject to the jurisdiction of the UCMJ?
Not that they need to agree to be subject to the jurisdiction of the UCMJ. That is an indication, Your Honor, of their joining the separate society that the Supreme Court identified in Parker v. Levy. In Mr. Ali's case, he was not subject to military orders. As the military judge found, as a matter of fact, he was free to refuse missions. And that is counter to what it means, the very essence of what it means to be a soldier.
But that presumes that you've got to be in the armed forces to be subject. Isn't that a pretty big presumption, given the history of the United States, the history of the Articles of War, and the history of the Code since 1950? And remember, we're talking about 2A10 here.
Your Honor, I don't think that it's a presumption. I think it falls.
We seem to be presuming that. You seem to say that if you're not a member of the armed forces of that separate society, you're not subject to jurisdiction. What are you saying?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that this court should apply the Toth Doctrine, which was first enunciated in Toth v. Quarles, and then actually recognized as the Toth Doctrine in Gugliardo.
And that's your least possible power?
Correct, Your Honor.
I just want to make sure I understand your version.
And was Toth a U.S. citizen?
He was, Your Honor.
Now, does the Fifth and Sixth Amendment of the Constitution apply to an alien outside the United States?
It does, Your Honor. And in the United States or Supreme Court case of Verdugo,
Verdugo's a Fourth Amendment case.
Yes, Your Honor. But there was significant, albeit dicta.
Dicta
that explains that the Fifth and Sixth Amendment says that it applies to persons. The Fourth Amendment identifies its applicability to citizens.
Could you point out where Verdugo says that? As I looked at Verdugo, I didn't get that. And I did get the fact that if an alien was in the United States and had substantial contacts to the United States, then they were afforded, in some cases, Fifth and Sixth Amendment protections. But I didn't. I mean, that's not the situation that we're dealing with here, is it?
Your Honor, if I could, I would like to give you that cite on rebuttal. I know it is in my brief, and I can provide you with that cite. I don't have that readily available.
Counsel, has there ever been a case in which this court, the Supreme Court, or a lower court has identified someone as serving with or accompanying the armed forces and subjected them to court-martial jurisdiction and said that they don't have all the rights of a U.S. citizen before a court-martial?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe there has been a case.
Let's talk about the Toth and the...
But, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I may have misunderstood.
My question was, is there any case in which a person who has been identified as serving with or accompanying the armed forces for purposes of court-martial jurisdiction was not given all the rights that a U.S. citizen was given before the court-martial?
Well, if I understand your question, Your Honor, there's two parts to my answer. The first part is that when a person is subjected to a court-martial jurisdiction, they receive military due process, and that's distinct from constitutional due process, including the Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights.
Has this court used the term military due process in the last quarter century, or have we applied the Constitution of the United States except as excluded?
That's correct, Your Honor. I get the phrase military due process from Bernie.
That's 1957 case.
Yes, Your Honor, but that is the case that the government relies on.
But I'm talking about right now. Members of the armed forces are given all the constitutional rights of their civilian counterparts unless there's a reason for excluding it. Has there ever been a circumstance in which a person who is an alien or a person who is not a U.S. citizen would be brought before a court-martial and not get all the same constitutional rights as a U.S. citizen would get before that court-martial?
I don't believe so.
Let me ask it a different way. Do foreign nationals serve in the United States military?
They have to have some sort of status, Your Honor. They don't have to be actual citizens, but they do have to, resident aliens I'm not sure what the term is, but they have to have some status that allows
lawful permanent residence.
Lawful permanent residence, yes, Your Honor.
So people serve in the United States military who are not, in fact, citizens yet?
Yes, Your Honor.
Correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And do they get all the constitutional rights of their counterparts who are U.S. citizens?
Well,
they're in the armed forces.
They get all the same constitutional rights as other soldiers. They do not receive the same constitutional rights.
Understood. Has there been a case in which a person who is not a citizen of the United States has been brought before an Article III court and has not been given all the constitutional rights of a citizen of the United States?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay,
Counsel,
so
you're not suggesting, or I don't think an issue in this case is that the appellee in this case wasn't afforded all the protections at his court-martial that other service members are, correct? You're not making that assertion?
No, Your Honor, we're not.
Making the assertion that he's due more. He's due more than our own troops are due under the code.
Our argument is that he is due all the rights and protections that are found in an Article III court.
And just to go back to my original question, because I'm still having trouble seeing how this isn't a facial challenge, but you're saying it's not a facial challenge because there could be a circumstance in which it would be okay if it was the least available, whatever the phrasing is,
the least power adequate. To the
right,
proposed.
But then what I understand from your brief is there's no set of circumstances in which that would be the case because they could always create a court, a different court, an Article III court that would have jurisdiction over him, or turn him over to Iraq, or turn him over to Canada. And in none of those circumstances would he fall under 2A10.
The fundamental problem, Your Honor, in this case is that Congress made a choice. They chose not to cover Mr. Ali by the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act.
So your answer is that since the solution you view this constitutional solution is to extend MEJA, that you are making a facial challenge to the statute.
The court in Toth recommended a MEJA type solution, Your Honor.
Yes, but MEJA was enacted to deal with a wholly separate problem. MEJA was enacted to deal with dependent misconduct overseas, where there really is a constitutional hole. MEJA was not enacted to deal with this question.
I mean, do you understand why saying that there's a way in which the statute can operate by making him subject to a different statute, not this one, doesn't take you out of the facial challenge land?
I think I understand your point, Your Honor.
Can I ask you to step back and act as if you're starting over? And there's a statutory application issue and there's a constitutional question. What is the issue you'd like us to focus on? If you thought we were going to decide this case in your favor, how would we decide it?
Your Honor, the fundamental problem in this case is that Congress made a choice not to cover host nation nationals. Now, to answer Judge Stuckey's question a little bit more in depth, while it may have been the case that MEJA was passed to address the results of the post-Toth cases whereby the Supreme Court found that there was no jurisdiction.
No, post-Reed v. Covert.
Post-Reed v. Covert.
Yeah, dependence overseas.
But if I could just give you one illustration of how MEJA is in fact employed to extend jurisdiction over contracts.
Counsel, is this your answer to my question? Something about MEJA?
It's part of the answer to your question.
What's the pivot point of this case?
The pivot point of this case, Your Honor, is that Congress has the authority to extend Article III jurisdiction over Mr. Ali. They chose
are
not
they constitutionally
to,
compelled to?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. They're not.
Okay, however, well, they made a choice that's within their power.
Do you understand the Chief Judge's question? He's saying, I think, put it in a different way, is your better argument that you win on constitutional grounds or on statutory grounds? And then why? Is that a different way of getting into your question?
I think the better argument, in fact, Your Honor, is that we should win on constitutional grounds.
Okay,
however,
and now why?
Because when Congress chose not to extend Article III jurisdiction and instead later chose to extend Article I court-martial jurisdiction over Mr. Ali, they violated the Toth Doctrine.
Okay, so your constitutional argument pivots on the Toth Doctrine.
Correct, Your
Honor. Your theory of the Toth Doctrine is it requires Congress to exercise the least possible power to accomplish the end. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Now, why isn't this the least possible power? It appears to be your theory that so long as there is a court open somewhere in the world, the obligation is to bring the person back to the United States. Is that correct?
That is, I think, the practical result of the theory, Your Honor. But as Justice Harlan said in his concurrence in Reed v. Covert, it's the absence of civil authority that makes military.
But it appears to me that so your argument essentially is so long as there is a court, an Article III court open in the United States, it matters not how hard the combat is, where the combat is, or what role this person or the witnesses that might be implicated in the case might be performing. It does not matter. The only option is to bring them back to the United States as a matter of constitutional law.
Unless the military has previously, I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so now he's on a submarine. He's a contractor on a submarine on alert, and they're supposed to surface, helo them back to the United States under your theory of the law. What's the limit of your doctrine? It seems to have no limit. It's a doctrine that swallows the whole and basically says, can't do it.
The answer, Your Honor, is found in Gugliardo, where the court said that the military has it within their means to make these individuals members of the armed forces, such as the Navy Seabees, who are actually incorporated into the armed forces.
Okay, and you're saying that jurisdiction over civilians accompanying, serving with or, and it's an or, it's not an and, serving with or accompanying the armed forces in the theater. Simply cannot attach unless they are quasi-enlisted.
I think, yes, Your Honor, unless they're...
Okay, now what's the... I don't see how you get there from Toth. Toth had to do with a discharged American serviceman in the United States, and here we have an alien contractor in Iraq. You're talking, you know, Reed v. Covert talked about 2A11, which in 1950 was a novelty. We're not talking about 2A11. We're talking about 2A10, which in 1950 wasn't a novelty. but continued a tradition of jurisdiction and went straight back to 1775. How do you answer the argument of history that this jurisdiction has been exercised at home and abroad? And we're talking about abroad here. We're talking about in theater, you know, assuming arguendo that it fits the facts, and we, you know, I'm not addressing your statutory argument. How do you get rid of nearly 200 plus years of history of exercising jurisdiction in theater in time of war and say, well, you know, Reed v. Covert, which deals with an entirely different matter, somehow applies?
Your Honor, I see that my time is about to expire, if I may answer.
It has not about to expire. It has, but you're welcome to continue to respond.
Your Honor, I would respectfully point to what the court said in starting in Reed v. Covert and Justice Frankfurter's concurrence, and actually adopted by the court in Gugliardo, that the materials that you refer to are too episodic, too meager to form a solid basis in history.
Frankfurter was talking about courts-martial in time of peace. They are hardly episodic when you look at the record of the use of military justice in time of war, which is what we're talking about today.
Well,
he was referring to something else.
If I may, can I answer?
Of course.
Thank you, Your Honor. The operations in Iraq were a contingency operation. They were not a declared war. So the same concerns that were present at the Averitt case, where you had the concern about military jurisdiction being exercised on a whole range of military-type operations, in this case contingency operations, is still present, and the Toth Doctrine controls.
Okay. One more question. Haven't we looked – hasn't American jurisprudence since Bah or Bass – I don't know how to pronounce it – Vitingy in 1800 looked to the actual existence of hostilities – and not to the question of whether it was declared or not?
I think, Your Honor, that in Bas, they were talking about a very different issue. There was the Fifth and Sixth Amendments were not implicated in that case. And as this court recognized in Averitt, when you delve into the very constitutionally sensitive area of subjecting civilians to courts-martial, the court should apply.
Well, wasn't this enacted by Congress? I mean, we don't know. But if you read the statute, doesn't this have the practical effect of overruling Averitt?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it
Averitt said this only kicks in declared war. This says it kicks in declared war or a contingency operation, which everyone admits this is.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that an overruling of Averitt by statute?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because Averitt
What is it?
Averitt didn't address this specific issue because contingency operation was not part of the
statute. No, but Averitt addressed the question of what was war for the purpose of 2A10.
I think, Your Honor, that the important piece to take away from Averitt is that the court applied the Toth Doctrine to analyze the statute, to interpret the statute as narrowly as possible in order to avoid the constitutional issues that inevitably arise when civilians are subjected to court-martial jurisdiction.
Counsel, I have two quick questions for you. You focus on the constitutional argument. If we were to focus on the statutory application argument, what would be your best argument?
Your Honor, my best argument is that Mr. Ali had no military status. He was not subject to military orders.
And therefore was not accompanying or serving with? Which portion of the statutory phrase are you focusing on?
He was not accompanying the armed forces, Your Honor, because the only definition that is in statute is in MEJA and SOFA for what it means to accompany the armed forces. And those statutes specifically exempt host nationals. And that's the same excuse that the government uses.
And that's your strongest argument if we're going to focus on that. You don't have to spell it all out. I just want to know where you would like us to focus.
I think my strongest argument, Your Honor, is that Mr. Ali was not an actual member of the armed forces because he was not subject to orders.
Okay, and in terms of the constitutional law question, is it your view Congress was acting here solely pursuant to the rules and regulations authority or also the war power and necessary and proper power?
They were acting solely in accordance with the make rules clause, Your Honor.
And is that your is that essential for you to win the case for us to determine that? Do you win or lose if the war power is applied as well?
I believe we should win even if the war power applies, Your Honor.
Very well. Thank you.
Counsel, I do have one question. And I'd like you to address covert at page 33 and 34, the Supreme Court's decision, where the court, after having a very strong statement against court-martial jurisdiction over civilians, over a broad set of circumstances, refers to the cases in which lower courts have held that jurisdiction existed, doesn't criticize those cases at all, and says, from a time prior to the adoption of the Constitution, the extraordinary circumstances present in the area of actual fighting have been considered sufficient to permit punishment of some civilians in that area by military courts under military rules. Has there been any Supreme Court decision since Covert that has cast doubt on that particular comment by the Supreme Court as to the existence of that power in the area of actual hostilities?
I don't believe, Your Honor, that there's been a Supreme Court case directly on point.
And so, putting aside Averitt, which I know you're not conceding Averitt, but let's assume that Averitt's a statutory interpretation decision by our court. What in this case would exclude this individual from being present in the area of actual finding that would permit his punishment by a military court? That is, taking the words of Covert, the words in which the court that was extremely critical of any military jurisdiction over civilians, recognizing that in the area of hostilities that jurisdiction would exist. Does this case fall under those circumstances or not?
It does not, Your Honor. I believe that the court in that particular passage was referring to the exercise of war powers. War powers is not at play in this case.
Why not?
No, there was no declared war, Your Honor.
War powers are only kicking in declared war? What are we doing over there? What were we doing in Korea? Dancing down the primrose path?
In that case, they also referred, as well as in Toth, to the cases of the hostilities involving the Indians. And I don't believe that those involved declared wars.
That's correct, Your Honor. But in the case of the inmates, they were in continuous custody as a result of court martial.
I was referring to the Indians, not inmates.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Counsel, you'll have more time on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Baker, judges of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Chad Fisher, and along with Colonel Michael Mulligan, we represent the United States. There's no question that Congress can assert court-martial jurisdiction over members of the land and naval forces pursuant to the Make Rules Clause of Article 1, Section 8. The issue in this case is whether Mr. Ali is a person who can be regarded as falling within the term land and naval forces.
Is it your view that Mr. Ali was a member of the land or naval forces?
Yes, Your Honor. For the purposes of the Make Rules Clause, he is a member of the Land and Naval Forces.
And if he isn't, do you lose?
I think so, Your Honor. Yes, our argument is...
So you mean the war power is not at play here?
No, Your Honor. We don't believe that the war powers are necessary in order to assert court-martial jurisdiction.
That's different than saying, is the war power a constitutional authority that is applicable in this instance? I hear you saying, no, this is a pure rules and regulations case.
Yes, Your Honor. That's the government's position. I think that pursuant to...
The government concedes that if he's not a member of the armed forces in some status, you lose?
I'm not conceding that point, Your Honor.
You seem to have just conceded it.
No, I don't think we need it in order to assert court-martial jurisdiction over Mr. Ali. Now, I recognize the quote in Covert.
I'm confused. Let me read on page 11 of your brief. A person who is to be tried by court-martial must be a person who can be regarded as falling within the term land and naval forces. Period?
For the purposes of this case, Your Honor, yes, I think so.
And so if we were to determine, as Justice Black did, that unless someone is actually serving in the land or naval forces, they are not subject to that regulation... constitutional regulation, you lose.
I think, Your Honor,
what you're saying. That's what we're hearing, by the way.
Technically, yes, Your Honor. We have not
technically,
asserted.
Yes or no, right? Yes.
Yes. We have not asserted the war powers as a basis for jurisdiction.
Why not?
Over Mr. Ali. Because I don't think that we need it, Your Honor.
Well, let's say that we think you do need it. Make your argument.
Well, Your Honor, there's the war powers.
If you're prepared to, and if you're not, then say you're not. I mean,
well, Your Honor, I'm not fully prepared to brief that. But I think that the war powers, I mean, the court, yes, they carved out that exception in Reed and said that to the extent those people in Perlstein and DiBartolo and Gerlach were not members of the land and naval forces, then it was based on the war powers. But our position is that, you know, they weren't clear about the cases in covert, but many of those people in those World War I and World War II cases were members of the land and naval forces, just like Mr. Ali.
What about the jurisdiction over sutlers and similar person under the Articles of War? Were they members of the land and naval forces, or are they simply accompanying them?
Well, Your Honor, I think that by nature of their accompaniment, they became members of the land and naval forces such that they were subject to jurisdiction.
At some point during this guy's pretrial confinement, he was fired by his civilian employer.
Yes, Your Honor.
He was no longer a contractor.
Yes, Your Honor. That's right.
Presumably, he no longer had a right to whatever ID card the contractors get. Okay. Now, how is he a member of the land and naval forces if he's no longer a contractor and the only reason he's there is that he's in pretrial confinement, which he's certainly not doing voluntarily?
Right. I understand that, Your Honor. And I think that the courts have addressed this. I mean, particularly in, I think it was Perlstein and Gerlach in many of these cases.
Well, if he's actually a member of the land and naval forces, why did they need to have a separate statutory provision? Why doesn't he just fall under the regular jurisdictional provisions?
Well, Your Honor, I think that Congress has the authority to distinguish between uniformed service members and a civilian who could become...
But it doesn't say that. It doesn't say members who are doing this are members of the land and naval forces, right? That's not what the statute says.
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. It's actually broader than that. It says persons who are serving with or accompanying.
But it doesn't go on to say they're members of the land and naval forces. I mean, that's the problem with your argument.
Well, Your Honor, I think we have to distinguish between the constitutional basis and then what Congress has decided to enact
You're using statutory language to address a constitutional issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
You need to stay within the constitutional framework if you're going to rely solely on land and naval forces.
I mean, let's think of it this way, right? I don't think anyone in this room disagrees that to the extent that jurisdiction is exercised or may be exercised over civilians by a military court, that to the extent that that can happen, that A, it has to be very narrow, and B, there has to be a constitutional basis for it.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree.
So now explain to us what the constitutional basis is for the statute. And you can't refer to the statutory language in order to answer the constitutional question.
Well, I agree, Your Honor. And the constitutional basis is the Make Rules Clause of Article 1, Section 8, which enables Congress to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces.
Isn't that a circular argument, though? I mean, you're arguing that the Make Rules Clause allows Congress to make rules, regulations, laws that govern the land and naval forces. But when you look at Article 2A1, they're talking about persons serving with or accompanying the armed forces. So how do you make that jump? I mean, it comes back, I think, to the initial question is whether or not this individual was in the land or naval forces, and whether or not persons serving with or accompanying the forces are part of those forces. If you look at the language in Article 2A1, it doesn't seem that they are. They're accompanying the forces. They're not part of the forces.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the court has used different language to describe the statute and the Constitution, but I think what we know from the case law is that the amenability of court-martial jurisdiction turns on your status.
We're looking here at the language of the statute and the language of the Constitution.
And we don't disagree that it turns on the status. The question is whether there's a constitutional basis for Congress to extend the status to these individuals. Do you understand the difference?
I do, Your Honor, and it's our position that by virtue of their either employment or by virtue of their serving with or by virtue of their accompaniment, they become so directly connected.
You're arguing they're de facto members of the land and naval forces. Is there some missing word here that we haven't found yet?
Well, Your Honor, I think that members of the land and naval forces is not exclusive to uniformed service members, and I think the court in Reed expressly said that on page 22 and 23, the court said, we recognize that there might be circumstances where a person could be in the armed services for purposes of Clause 14, even though he had not been formally inducted into the military or did not wear the uniform. So it's that is
so
what I'm relying
on. That's
the
hinge to your
okay.
argument.
Yes.
The trigger, the statutory trigger is declared war or a contingency operation. Both of which, declared war is a, you know, an obvious doctrine, and a contingency operation implies actual hostilities. So how are we not under the war power here?
I don't think that contingency operation in all circumstances, Your Honor, requires
well, you read the statutory definition. No, but it is a situation in which the reserves are called up. You read the statutory definition in 101. A contingency operation strongly implies actual hostility.
It does, Your Honor, but, you know, for example, Operation Unified Response, the earthquake relief in Haiti, was a contingency operation.
What do you do about the language in Covert where the Supreme Court specifically says that the constitutional power to create court-martial jurisdiction over civilians, if such power exists, arises from Congress's war powers?
Your Honor, that quote from Covert was referring to the World War I and World War II district court cases, so the Pearlsteins, and what the court said was, to the extent they are not members of the Land and Naval Forces, then it must rest on Congress's war powers. So there's
okay,
really
well,
two bases.
Let's for the sake of argument, assume as your premise for your continuing constitutional discussion that you've not persuaded us that they're members of the Land and Naval Forces by virtue of a statute that says the people that are accompanying, okay, serving with or accompanying, whatever the specific language is. So focus on an argument that doesn't make us assume that civilians are members of the Land and Naval Forces.
Well, Your Honor, he's not a civilian. It's the government's position that at the time that he engaged in this employment and took a job with
So if we disagree with you and we say, no, he's a civilian, you lose?
We lose under the make rules clause argument, yes, Your Honor.
Well, and you're not making any other argument.
No, we're not making any other argument.
Why are you so opposed to the war powers argument?
I'm not opposed to it, Your Honor.
Why
I just don't
think... Are
you
making it? You seem to be just pushing us back.
I mean, no, that, I just don't
it
think
appears
that
appears to be an alternative basis for a constitutional... for the statute.
And it appears to be at least somewhat compelled by the language of the article.
There is, Your Honor, I think, an alternative basis under the war powers. But the problem is that's not well defined. There's no left and right limits, if you will, or doctrine that we can apply.
So it's well defined that when a person from Canada gets hired by a civilian contractor and goes down to Fort Benning and takes a few courses and sends over Iraq, it's obvious that he's now a member of the armed forces, even though he doesn't have military pay, even though he doesn't have military full military benefits at that point, even though he's not, as the military judge found, subject to specific orders to the extent that he can refuse. He's a member of the armed forces.
But, Your Honor, let me just, that last bit, the finding by the military judge was that he had the ability to refuse missions. And I think that that is different than saying he had the right to refuse orders. I think the evidence established that once he goes on a mission, he is subject to the orders of the squad leader of the 170th MP Company.
Did the military judge find that specifically?
No, he didn't, Your Honor, but I think that we can presume that the military used...
But if he refuses the order to go on the mission, you never get there.
That's true, Your Honor, and if there were evidence in the record that Mr. Ali had refused missions, I think there'd be a much stronger argument for the appellant that he was not necessarily a member of the Land and Naval Force, but there's no evidence.
Is the reason that you're being resistant to the war powers is because you say, well, there's no logical limit because if it's not an actual war and it includes contingency operations, oh, my goodness, then the sky could fall and this could apply to too many people and then you won't like that. I mean, is that what's going on?
Well, I think it's difficult to identify a limiting principle.
Why isn't a limiting principle as applied challenges? I mean, have you read the amicus brief?
What about the limiting principle of hostilities, active hostilities?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I mean,
Why isn't that a limiting principle?
I think the limiting principle are all three requirements of Article 2A10. I think that it's contingency operation combined with in the field, combined with accompanying and serving.
Why doesn't that serve to cap whatever assertion of war power the President may or may not be asserting?
It might, Your Honor, but again, I just don't think... based on the facts, based on the strength of Mr. Ali's direct connection to the armed forces, that we need to rely on the war powers in order to assert jurisdiction over Mr. Ali.
If it's that clear that he was a member, why doesn't the contract just say so? There seems that each side has lined up 349 facts, and the one fact that seems to be missing is that none of these materials say, and welcome aboard.
I think that's right, Your Honor, but...
And that would be pretty easy for the government to write in, right?
It would, Your Honor, but 2 points on that. I think the military judge, first of all, found made a factual finding that Mr. Ali was aware that he could be subject to the UCMJ. Not in the contract, but as part of his training, he was made aware that he could be subject to the UCMJ. But the second point on that, Your Honor, is that the court in McCune versus Kilpatrick addressed this question specifically as far as whether or not the appellant needs to have knowledge of UCMJ jurisdiction. And the court said absolutely not. The statute doesn't say knowingly accompany the armed forces. It says accompany the armed forces. And it's objective. It's an objective test based on the totality of the circumstances.
What role does necessity of anything play in any of your arguments? Necessity meaning that this is necessary in order to accomplish the military mission, or you fill in the necessity?
I think it is necessary, Your Honor. I mean, in terms of the members of the 178th MP Company need to know that Mr. Ali is going to...
I don't think that was his question. I think his question is, what role does that factor play in whether your argument? Not whether there was necessity, but what role does necessity play in whether you win or lose, or whether this statute is okay?
It's part of the argument, Your Honor, but I think that the Supreme Court has clearly said that it is not sufficient in order to assert court-martial jurisdiction.
But is it necessary?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that...
So if it's a necessity for the mission... How come there's – how many cases have there been using this authority?
That I know of, Your Honor, this is the only one that I know of. I couldn't say.
And what does that tell us about the necessity of having this authority if it's part of your argument?
I don't think it tells us anything, Your Honor, because, I mean, I think the question for the court is limited to the facts of this case. But, again, I don't think that necessity answers the jurisdiction.
The constitutional question may not be limited, though, because we're looking at how the Constitution applies in this and other contexts.
That's true, Your Honor, but I mean, I think that the Supreme Court has been fairly clear in telling the government not to come to the court with explanations such as, if we don't have court-martial jurisdiction, this person is not going to be prosecuted. I think it's very clear that that is not a basis for asserting court-martial jurisdiction. They have to be, at least in the government's position, they have to be a member, or their connection must be so strong and sufficient to make them a member of the land and naval forces.
Why doesn't the least restrictive means test play into the question of the availability of another forum? I mean, here the MEJA has been in effect, the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, for over a decade. Justice Department has testified that it's been used in numerous cases. Despite all the years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the thousands of individuals who have served as contractors, and the significant allegations of misconduct on behalf of contractors and the significant cases that have been brought against contractors under MEJA, we have one case in which an individual is sentenced to 5 months confinement reduced to 115 days. Now, under MEJA, you've got a very similar case, the Brehm case. South African contractor for a U.S. company involved in an assault against another contract employee, a contractor for USAID, with a knife, very similar to this case. And that happened in November of 2010. He's brought to the United States in January, and by July there's a sentence of 42 months confinement. What about that case or anything in this record or the legislative history of the 2006 amendment to Article 2 tells us that the power that's being exercised here is the least power adequate to the means?
Well, Your Honor, a couple things on that. First, as far as the applicability of MEJA, I think the record and the military judge in ACCA had noted that MEJA does not apply by the terms of the statute to host nation national.
Right, so I think a question is this much ado about a class of persons equaling exactly one, meaning that this statute has only been used in a situation like this, which it appears to be the situation that has come up, where the accused is a host nation national. And if so, why does that justify the necessity for the statute at all, as opposed to some other means?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a difference between the necessity for the statute and the necessity as far as good order and discipline. But I think the language that Judge Efron was...
But, I mean, you can't have one without the other, right?
Well, just because the statute hasn't been used, Your Honor, doesn't necessarily mean that it's not necessary to good order and discipline in the unit.
In this one case?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but I just don't. I don't think that the number of times the statute has been used informs the constitutional question or the jurisdictional analysis.
Didn't the Supreme Court in Covert and in Toth, in Covert, take a look at the number of individuals, and then later again in Guagliardo and Kinsella, and say, yeah, there are a lot of dependents out there who are murdering their spouses, and we have other problems that are going on, but we don't think the armed forces will fall apart if Congress doesn't figure out a way to prosecute them. So doesn't the Supreme Court tell us that the volume and its actual impact on discipline is a factor to be considered, not necessarily a determinative factor, but a factor to be considered with respect to constitutionality of the statute?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think in the context in which that argument was raised, it was really in response to the government's arguments about why we need jurisdiction. I don't think that they were using that, or the Supreme Court was using that, as a basis for overturning the statute. I think the basis was essentially that civilian dependents are not members of the land and naval forces, whether they're stationed in the United States or stationed overseas. But if I could come back to your question about the availability of alternative forums, I think that that language from Toth is really just a legal conclusion. I think that the real question is, how do we determine whether or not something is the least possible power? And I think the Supreme Court has told us a couple things about that. First, I think that the availability of alternative forums does not inform that at all. The Supreme Court has never phrased the test in terms of the availability of alternative forums.
Wasn't Justice Harlan's concurring vote in Covert critical to getting a majority in that case, and he relied on that proposition?
I think he did, Your Honor, but again, there's no opinion of the court in Covert to begin with.
That's right. There wouldn't have been a decision in that case had he not joined it and offered that rationale.
Your Honor, I don't disagree that
Did any of the members of the plurality disagree with that rationale?
I don't think they did, Your Honor. And I recognize the fact that that argument is out there, and I think that the appellant and the appellant's amicus make that argument very heavily. But that line from Toth says, court-martial jurisdiction must be the least possible power. So it applies to all court-martial jurisdiction. It does not apply to court-martial jurisdiction just over civilians who have become members of the land and naval forces. And clearly, a service member can be made subject to federal criminal law. Under the appellant's theory, I think 2A7 definitely goes away, because we can certainly subject inmates to federal jurisdiction. But one other point I'd like to make on that, Your Honor, is that the case law doesn't support that proposition. Specifically, Ex parte Milligan was a martial law case. Now, there's no doubt that the Supreme Court in Milligan looked at whether or not the civil courts were functioning, but that was a martial law case, and martial law is intended to be a substitute for civilian law. So it makes sense to look at whether or not the civil courts are functioning before you institute martial law.
May I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor. Please.
How would the government's argument apply or not apply in the context of a domestic contingency operation? Let's say you have a foreign national interpreter working at NORAD as part of Noble Eagle, and they're there to ensure that they can communicate effectively with foreign national pilots flying into the United States to avoid them getting shot down for a scenario. Does the government's argument apply in that context or not?
I think it does, Your Honor, and I think what we're getting at is really the in-the-field prong of 2A10, and I think that...
So just to be clear, and your time's over, but since you're answering my question, you can continue. and if there are any others. To be clear, you're saying that this would apply equally, mutatis mutandis, within the United States if it was a contingency operation in the United States.
I think so, Your Honor, assuming that the facts establish that some part of the United States has become the field for the purpose of 2A10.
Well, let me ask you this. Is the government's view that Operation Noble Eagle is the field?
No, Your Honor, it's not.
Why is it not?
Well, I think, where are we referring to, Your Honor? We're just referring to the
airspace, defense of the airspace, Operation Noble Eagle. It's right. A contingency operation. It's been so designated. Why is that not the field, or is it the field?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court, I think, has defined in the field, and Bernie, I think, the court in Bernie defined in the field.
But they weren't addressing Noble Eagle, and I'm asking the government, which has a unique responsibility for Operation Noble Eagle, to tell me what its view is as to whether that's a contingency operation that would fall within the context of the statute.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know the precise left and right limits of Operation Noble Eagle, but I think I don't think that the facts establish that the United States...
Well, just generally, if pilots are flying sorties against perceived threats and are authorized to let their weapons go, I mean, isn't that a conflict situation?
Potentially, Your Honor. I mean, I think like the World War I or World War II cases, right, if we're talking about occupied Germany.
No, we're talking about Operation Noble Eagle and if pilots were authorized to let their weapons go.
Within the bounds of the United States.
Within the bounds of the United States, they were authorized? Well, I still think that the interpreter would need to be in an area of actual hostilities. And
he's supporting the mission. I mean, if he's talking to foreign pilots, we're bringing tankers.
And the mission
over.
Is the airspace above his head.
Sure, I understand that, Your Honor, but I think the question is, where are actual hostilities taking place?
Now you're importing actual hostilities, where before you were going on and on about him being a member of the armed forces, which is it?
I mean,
he was responding to my question, in fairness.
Is your answer then that whether A-10 applies depends on the existence of hostilities? I mean, that it's not just the language of the statute, but that it's limited by additional factors?
Your Honor, I don't think that 2A10 applies unless we are in the field, and in the field is defined as an area of actual fighting. So if the United States had become an area of actual fighting, then yes, I think that it would apply.
I'm not prepared at this time to address the specific 9/11 Noble Eagle question. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say, Your Honor, because I don't know the left and right.
I don't want to put you in a box. It's a critical question, and I don't want you to say something right. Just to survive the moment and live with it.
And all this is disregarding the DOD directive that places additional limits on the exercise of 2A10 jurisdiction.
As far as approval authority, yes, Your Honor, I think it does.
One more question from Judge Ryan.
The other question I have is in terms of... again, assume for the sake of my question that I don't agree with you that these are members of the Air and Naval Forces. So just assume that for the base of my question, okay? Would it matter in terms of necessity, in your view, if the accused in this case, rather than being an Iraqi national, had been a U.S. citizen subject to MEJA?
No.
In that case, you think that this would still be that it would still be appropriate to exercise court-martial jurisdiction as opposed to Article III jurisdiction if both forms were available?
Yes, Your Honor, because I don't think that they are not mutually exclusive.
Well, I understand that MEJA says that they're not mutually exclusive, but I'm asking you in terms of the constitutional question, we're testing the limits of your theory.
Yes, Your Honor, and again, I think that comes back to, again, the availability of alternative forms.
And so now I'm telling you there is an alternative forum, and it's in the United States.
Right, and it's our position, Your Honor, that the availability of alternative forums neither creates nor defeats court-martial jurisdiction.
Thank you, Counsel.
Counsel, may I ask one question?
Brief.
Actual hostilities. If this court were to adopt that as a limiting principle for the phrase in the field, military judge today in Iraq were to determine that in an identical situation there were no actual hostilities taking place. Let's assume that that finding isn't clearly erroneous. It's the government's position that there would be no jurisdiction under the statute? That's right. If a military judge today were to determine under the conditions today in Iraq, we'd have the identical situation of this case, that there were no actual hostilities. That is otherwise a person accompanying the armed forces, that it is otherwise a contingency operation, but it is not actual hostilities. Would the government agree that there is no jurisdiction in that case?
I think so, Your Honor. I mean, I think that in a qualified way, right? I don't think that bullets need to be flying over the courthouse in order for them to be in the field.
I understand. I'm not asking you to define the term actual hostilities. I'm saying if the military judge were to find, as a matter of fact, there were no, in a matter of law, mixed question, that there were no actual hostilities, and that was not clearly erroneous, would the government agree that there's no jurisdiction?
I think so, Your Honor. I think in that hypothetical, we would fail on the third prong as far as in the field.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. There's a written amicus brief on behalf of the appellant that's in the record, and we're now going to hear amicus argument on behalf of the government, I believe.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Judge, Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Jeff Barnum, and I'm appearing on behalf of amicus in support of the government. To start, we are making the argument that the proper constitutional source of authority for Article 2A10 is the War Powers.
Why do you use the phrase de facto war so often? Why not just call it hostilities, conflict, or contingency?
Because, Your Honor, I was making a distinction between de facto and a declared war. And actual hostilities would qualify as a...
So there's nothing magic about the word war. You're not trying to bleed war in. You would say that your argument stays the same if there's hostilities?
Yes, Your Honor.
Hostilities that fall within the definition of a contingency operation?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the war power would apply if there's hostilities. It's not necessarily necessary for a court, for example, to determine that there's a de facto war as opposed to merely hostilities.
Your Honor, for the war powers to be triggered, hostilities would be the important factor.
You've answered my question. Thank you.
The government shies away from using the war powers as the constitutional source of authority because there's no limiting principle. We believe that there are four factors that can be derived from the cases.
When you say that there's no limiting principle, do you mean that they've identified no limiting principle or that there is no limiting principle?
Your Honor, that the government couldn't identify a limiting principle. However, the Supreme Court and lower federal courts have identified a total of four factors which must be considered when court-martialing a civilian for their conduct in a combat theater while accompanying a military force.
Well, today the government has identified actual fighting, actual hostilities as a limiting principle. Why isn't that sufficient?
Your Honor, there are three other factors which include the civilian's role within the military unit, the nature of the offense and its impact upon the military mission, and the particular importance of using the court-martial.
Counsel, with respect to the last point that you made, I'll ask you the same question that I asked the government's counsel. You say in your brief that with respect to the comparative advantage, you note that the existence of an alternative form would be important, right?
Your Honor, it is part of that factor, but an alternative.
So in a case, if we change the facts of this case so that there was in fact an alternative forum, meaning that this individual was subject to MEJA and could have been had his trial take place in a federal district court, in your view, would that factor into the analysis as to whether he should be tried under the UCMJ?
It would factor into the analysis. However, it's important to note that an alternate forum is not an equivalent forum.
So in your view, getting back to the question I asked appellant at the beginning, I asked him whether this was a facial or an as-applied challenge. I think what you're saying is that as a facial matter that the statute is constitutional, but that as-applied challenges could be made based on these four factors. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has noted that the military may court-martial civilian in certain circumstances, and these four factors identify the constitutional circumstances.
Just to be clear, is this a totality of the circumstances test? Is this a weigh all of the factors and see which one feels strongest? Is this a they all must be present test?
Your
factors are quite clear. You've laid them out, but I just don't know what the predicate is. I have to find each of those to check the box, or just that one is really present?
Your Honor, all four factors must be present to some degree.
Can you tell us how they were present to some degree in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. The first factor was the proximity to hostilities, and in this case, Mr. Ali was at the very heart of hostilities. Every time he left the combat outpost, he and his military unit faced threats from improvised explosive devices and small arms fire.
Are you prepared to say at what point I don't know if approximation is a word, his proximity to hostilities is not close enough?
I'm not prepared to make that point right now, Your Honor. However, in this case...
And you understand why, because in your own brief you talk about there's two trends here. One is the use of contractors, and the other is the use of global power, and that we project global power from the United States overseas, and that we've used many contractors. So this issue about proximity to hostilities is critical. I appreciate that you're saying this meets it. I don't want to tell you when you fall off. Can you kind of walk me back and tell me a little bit?
Yes,
Your Honor.
Can
you at least tell me when I know I'm off?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then I know where the gray area is defined?
If it's a scale that is 0 to 10, the appellant's at 10, and perhaps Aviano Air Force Base would be 0.
Okay. Is this geographic?
It is geographic to a certain degree.
I mean that proximity can be geography or it can be sort of a combat action ribbon type of thing, which is if you're eligible for a combat action ribbon, you're eligible for this clause. Otherwise, you're not.
Your Honor, it is a geographic term. And the reason for that is because when you are in the presence of actual hostilities or proximate to it, the need to adhere to military discipline is especially important. And thus, the closer you get to hostilities, the more important this factor becomes. The second factor is the civilian's role within the military unit. And this is measured by the degree of importance the civilian's role is to the accomplishment of the mission.
Counsel, related to that issue, and if you're not prepared to discuss it, that's totally okay because it's not in your amicus brief. Do you have a view with respect to the strength of the government's argument that that government contractors, by their very nature, are members of the land and naval forces? Do you agree with that statement?
I do not agree with that statement, Your Honor. I think I think the court appropriately identified many of the logistical problems with shoehorning contractors into the land and naval forces, which is why we believe that the war powers are the most appropriate constitutional source of authority. And in this case, control of the battlefield is at the very heart of the war powers. War powers were there to enable the national government to wage war effectively. And here, Congress passed laws, and I'm quoting from Ex Parte Milligan, that Congress can pass all legislation essential to the prosecution of the war with vigor and success. And surely the imposition of military discipline at the battlefront meets that particular test.
Go back to your four factors, please, if you would, because what you're doing is trying to suggest to us where the limit of authority may lie. You've provided a contextual test, and it's not clear where the context gets gray and where it falls off.
Yes, Your Honor. So the second factor is the civilian's role or the essentialness to the mission. And on the 10 scale would be the appellant without whom the military police squad could not function. And at the other end of the spectrum would be Stephen Colbert, who may be accompanying the forces but is not critical to the operational success.
Does it matter whether they're performing a core military function or not?
No, Your Honor. It's the degree to which the civilian's role is critical to the operation's success.
Cook, they could be just as important as an interpreter because armies fight on their stomachs.
It's possible, Your Honor. The third factor is the extent to which this type of offense impacts the mission. And courts have always upheld jurisdiction when the nature of the offense impacted the mission. For example, in the Revolutionary War, embezzlement; in the Civil War, selling liquor to the troops; and in World War I, refusing to stand watch for submarines.
So in which case has the Supreme Court or another court used that test to assess jurisdiction as opposed to describing jurisdiction?
Your Honor, no case has held that jurisdiction turned on the nature of the offense.
So why should we apply that as a criteria then? Why should we impose that and rewrite the statute to write that in there as a congressional requirement?
Your Honor, it's an important factor for the constitutional test because it's inherent in the war powers. If the offense does not affect the conduct of the war, it's difficult to see how that punishing that offense would be constitutional under the war powers. And in this case, Mr. Ali's actions were detrimental to the mission, but perhaps not as detrimental as, say, sabotage or espionage. And on the other end of the spectrum, if Mr. Ali passed a bad check to pay his utility bill back in Canada, that would not be would not meet this particular a particular test.
I see you're running out of time. Can I ask a question? Counsel, and again, if you're not prepared to discuss this, it's because it's not the subject of your particular brief, but you seem well-versed in this area. You know, assuming that an appellee such as this one received all the protections of a court-martial, and as a foreign national with a court-martial taking place outside of the United States, do you have a view as to whether we even need to reach the constitutional issues at all, or put another way, why are the Fifth and Sixth Amendment arguments that appellee is making with respect to why he needed more than a court-martial relevant or applicable at all?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I'm not prepared to answer that.
You've relied on the war power. I see you're out of time. This will be a short question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You've relied on the war power. Congress passed this statute. The President implemented it. To what extent, if at all, should a court exercise any degree of deference in this war power national security matter, in your view?
Your Honor, the court should apply a limited deference because here we're talking about the undivided war powers of the national government. And as the Supreme Court noted in Rotzker v. Goldberg, judicial deference in this area should be at its apogee.
That would be great deference.
Well, yeah,
great
deference. I'm confused, yeah.
Thank you.
Limited.
Limited.
Leave me with your soundbite on that one then, because you're sort of both places.
Your Honor, because the executive and the legislative branches were working in concert, the undivided war powers, judicial deference should be limited.
So it's Youngstown.
Yes, Your Honor.
No.
This would be the third.
Limited. Is it defer
like
a lot or defer a little?
It would be defer a lot.
Defer a lot, but defer a lot means if it's state secrets, courts defer a lot, as in they don't even look behind the thing sometimes.
You would
say
great deference. It's great deference. Apogee equals great deference, and nadir means little deference.
Great deference. Yes, great deference.
No.
So shortly after the court decided Youngstown in 1952, the Supreme Court, in a series of cases with Toth, Covert, Guagliardo, did any of those cases reflect any degree of deference beyond the normal deference that the court would provide to a statute passed by Congress? Was there any foreign policy or war powers deference in those cases?
No, Your Honor, because each one of those cases was grounded in the Make Rules Clause. And because there were neither Reed, Kinsella, Guagliardo, or Grisham, there were all peacetime cases. Here we're talking about an area of active hostilities that have been going on for several years.
Consul, can you briefly address your fourth factor before you sit down?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the importance to it, or the extent to which a court-martial is important in maintaining good order and discipline on the battlefield. A court-martial is uniquely effective in this regard because it proceeds with dispatch, it's designed to take place in theater, and it's visible to the fighting force.
Then why shouldn't they be using court-martials for all of the offenses that are taking place instead of bringing everyone else back to the United States?
Your Honor, because in an area of actual hostilities, a battlefield commander is concerned primarily with achieving the military objective and not necessarily court-martialing anyone that may or may not deserve it. They will only take action in severe cases such as this one where there's a very serious threat to good order and discipline.
Is that threat to good order and discipline in this case if there was no alternative form available?
Again, Your Honor, that's a factor, but even if an alternative form was available, a court-martial in this case was appropriate.
Thank you, counsel. As you've learned, we have either can't tell time or have a flexible sense of what 10 minutes means.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your argument. We will now hear a rebuttal, please, from the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to make 3 points on rebuttal. The first, the court and the government discussed Operation Noble Eagle, as we briefed in appellant's brief. The problem is there is no definition for in the field in the statute, and there's no congressional history for what that means. So that leaves us with the Supreme Court precedent, specifically in Judge Harlan's concurrence. Again, one of the elements of in the field has to mean the absence of civil authority. That's what makes military jurisdiction appropriate. And even
the absence of civil authority in the United States or anywhere in the world.
Well, in today's modern age, Your Honor, as demonstrated by the Bram case, Mija case, modern transportation, modern communication makes it possible.
You mean in the United States? That is an easy, short question.
Yes, Your Honor, in the United States, in the availability of communication with the United States.
But that's not this case, and we don't have to decide the parade of horribles to decide this case, do we? What you're arguing is saying that, you know, horrible things will happen, the roof will fall in, and constitutional liberty will die. But we don't have to decide that today, do we? This is a case of an alien in an alien land, in a time of actual hostilities.
Well, do we need to
reach your parade of horribles?
No, Your Honor, but this goes to my second point, the issue of necessity. You know, this is one case that the government apparently chose to use as some sort of test case. And if the court refers to the newest version of AR 2710, which is referenced in our brief, and in fact, they exempt the host nationals as a matter of Army regulation from court-martial jurisdiction. So, in fact, if that regulation had been in place at the time of Mr. Ali's court-martial, we would not be here today. So, certainly, there was no overwhelming military necessity.
Making a due process argument, or what are you making?
No, Your Honor. I'm responding to the government's argument of military necessity as a reason to overcome the requirement for Article 3 jurisdiction as opposed to court-martial jurisdiction.
So if going forward the Army has exempted host nationals from court-martial jurisdiction as a matter of their own decision, and if at this time all other individuals are sent back to the United States and tried under MEJA, we're back to my question, which is this is a case about one particular person, a class of one. Which doesn't change our the duty for us to decide the case, but I'm just asking you, is this all about this particular individual?
It seems so, Your Honor, but it's odd that the government chose to use this as a test case and then
promptly... Well, if it's the only case, I mean, if it's the only case, they don't have many alternatives, right?
Well, and I believe in the amicus for appellants brief references several other cases that were initially brought and then withdrawn. For what reason, I don't know.
Well, but that happens all the time in court martials too, right? People, charges preferred and then they're withdrawn.
It was in response to habeas petitions, Your Honor, at which point the government apparently decided that it wasn't worth the effort. But
make sure you get your third point out.
Yes, sir. Back to Judge Efron's question, Your Honor, in reference to the applicable pages in Verdugo, it starts at page 265 and concludes on 266, the analysis where the Fifth and Sixth Amendment apply to all persons versus the Fourth Amendment applies to U.S. citizens. That's page 265 and 266. Actually, Your Honor, I do have one more point in reference to the War Powers Act or the War Powers applicability. I would refer the court to footnote number 2 in the Gugliardo case. And in that case, the lower courts based their decision, and in fact the charging decision and the jurisdictional decision was based on Article 211, not the War Powers Act. And so the Supreme Court declined to decide Gugliardo on the War Powers Act. And I think that is
the War Powers Constitution, not the War Powers Act.
I'm sorry. Yes, Your Honor. The War Powers found in the Constitution.
So does that tell us anything more than those cases do not establish a binding precedent at this point, and that this court, while it must pay attention to what the Supreme Court said in the covert through Guagliardo set of cases, is not bound by any of them with respect to Article 2A10.
Well, Your Honor, I think it informs your question earlier about Reed v. Covert, pages 22 through 23, where they make reference to these other situations where civilians were subjected to court-martial jurisdiction right. under the war powers theory.
Right, but isn't this, in fact, isn't this what you said in your brief, that is, that this is, in fact, a case of first impression at this stage?
It's a case of first impression, Your Honor, yes, because of the insertion of the words contingency operation into the statute. But I would go back to our main point in the argument, and that is that the Toth Doctrine applies.
Counsel, you're out of time. Would you care to summarize in one sentence or less? You may summarize if you wish.
Certainly, Your Honor. The Toth Doctrine controls the jurisdictional analysis in this case. Congress chose not to extend Article III jurisdiction and instead chose to use court-martial jurisdiction as a catch-all jurisdiction, and that violates the constitutional principles enunciated in Toth.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, all counsel, including amicus. The case is now submitted. Before we recess the court, let me just say we're going to recess the court. You can practice standing up and down. We'll stay in place, and after that, we'll then do questions and answers if you would like. This is a good time to escape if you have a class. But if you don't, we hope you'll stay and ask questions of counsel as well as the bench. The ground rule, of course, is not to ask any questions that either directly, indirectly, or veiled are addressed to the case. Fair enough, but you can ask questions about the military justice system or anything like that. So please, where's our clerk of the court? Okay, thank you. Could you please...
All rise.